Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
Raised in Brooklyn, the Bronx, and some of the other boroughs of Manhattan. Come from a heritage. The mother's side was from Austria, which is a Germanic type of background. Father's side was from Russia and Poland. So it's the Slavic background on his side. And I guess I'm in line for all the Polish jokes that come up, or partially so. How I got into ventriloquism
per se. Your parents, what did they do for a living? And what kind of parents were they?
I'd rather not get into that.
Okay.
My father was a tailor.
All right.
Mother was a housewife.
Okay.
That's about all. It was during the Depression, 1929. It's very hard times, lots of poverty. Comparable to the welfare they have today was a thing called home relief. So we lived from hand to mouth in tenements and broken down environments. Real ghetto stuff. That was the start.
But you had a lot of humor back then. I mean, were you kind of a classic clown at all?
No. No humor whatsoever.
No.
No humor, no. Too pathetic.
Really?
Too much pathos and too much pain and poverty to have much humor or to think there was anything much to laugh about. The change actually came when I was 13. And prior to 13, I was studying to be an artist. I wanted to be a commercial artist and a sculptor and studying of puppetry, lettering, printing, painting, all of that. And I went to the appropriate schools to take up that kind of work. The switch came at around the 13th year, as I said, by coming across one of these ads in a magazine from an old Johnson & Johnson back in Battle Creek, Michigan, or Kellogg, Michigan, something like that, where it said, send away 10 cents, and we'll send you a thing called a ventro whistle with a little book on ventriloquism. Throw your voice in the trunk, surprise your friends, become a ventriloquist, throw your voice in the next room where people are arguing, have a lot of fun with it. So I managed, as desperate as it was at that time, to get a dime together. It took me many months. I finally got the dime, sent away for it, and received this little membrane reed made in Japan. Maybe you've seen it, like a half of a circle. The membrane reed, and then, well, unfortunately, that's all you could do with it. Thank you. Was to whistle.
It's the kind you get at carnivals.
Yes, you couldn't speak unless you wanted to go into a Punch and Judy type of vocal quality, or something that might sound comparable to a parakeet, but you really couldn't speak or get any delineation or changes of voices. It wasn't that flexible a gadget. But the book that came with it, there's where the interest began. As I began to study the book and the short little pamphlet that it was, I began to get enough of the rudiments plus the fascination to want to go further and to want to study further. And then I would get some books from the library written by various people. Edgar Bergen's book. At that time, of course, Bergen was very big on radio, and occasionally he would do a motion picture, which I'd have to go to see, and that got me even more and more interested, and I wanted to be like him. Mm-hmm. I set my cap to maybe grow up and be like Bergen. Didn't intend to leave my art studies go, but because combined with the study of art, we also had a course in puppetry. That gave me the facility to build a little dummy to which I could put to use the ventriloquial skill that I had achieved up until that point. Now I needed this figure. So in the puppetry class, I made Jerry Mahoney, or a comparable figure for that crude development at that time, out of paper mache. Paper mache, yeah, the first Jerry, crude. out of a papier-mâché newspaper stock that I used. And now I began to exhibit this more or less gregarious attitude and humor that you just spoke about. Because I brought this to my school, first in the attempt to make the puppet, asking the advice of the teachers there, and learning how to do it in school as one of my class projects. That kind of got me going. While at home at the same time, I was practicing the techniques in front of the mirror of ventriloquy. And after having mastered quite a bit of that for that time and finishing up with the puppet, I was able to put both of the things together. And now, at the time, in my school, there was a, thank you very much. There was a class project, which is, I think, still in existence back in New York, called the GO, which was the General Organization. And they would elect students as officers of the GO, president, vice president. And I determined to become a spokesman for these students.
Excuse me, I'll leave this. He needs some help.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And as the campaign went into full swing, I was very nonpartisan. Didn't find myself latched into any one candidate, but just in general, going out there and like a campaign manager at large for all of the kids. They began to send me from classroom to classroom with a dummy. I had no script or material, and I would just ad-lib for the fact that there wasn't any routine for me to use at the time. So I took as my offshoot a question that even a dummy should know who to vote for in GO. And if you kids have any questions, I'll try to answer them. Then they'd raise hands, I'd call upon the children, they'd ask questions, which Jerry would respond to. This was before I had had any experience, and I was very reticent and diffident and shy, so I didn't do any talking. I let it all come from him. But it was adequate, and I began to compose material with humor right on the spot, until finally the principal heard of this activity, called me up to his office, which was frightening at that moment. What did I do wrong? And he said that a very close friend of his was a man named Major Bowes. This goes back to 1930s. And that he would like to speak to Major Bowes about giving me a chance on the program, because if I won that contest for that evening, the prize was $100, which he knew that my family and I could use, plus it would give me an opportunity to mention the name of the school a few times, which is what the principal really wanted. That was his motivation.
Incidentally, were you an only child, or do you have brothers and sisters?
No, I had two sisters. Should we turn this off while I just have some of this breakfast?
So we left you at your school and with the principal?
Yes, the next step was to go to the Major Bowes group and to do an audition. They were holding auditions for out-and-out amateurs, and I showed up with my connection of the school principal, and they were expecting me, and they had me do an audition. What I had done at that time is, there was a publication out called 10,000 Jokes. So I picked up one of these magazines and just very primitively tied together about 20 or 30 jokes, made a little routine out of it. And I auditioned for the Bowes people, and they accepted me and scheduled me to appear on the radio show. Well, I appeared on the radio show just as scared as any newcomer who was doing something like this, besides the fact that it was a network coast-to-coast show, and it was, wow, way above anything I'd ever attempted coming out of school. And for some strange reason, not only did I win the contest that night, but I still hold the record for the greatest number of telephone call votes
Oh, really?
That ever came into that program. I was then swept off my feet by a very lucrative offer to go out on the road and to play theaters with the Major Bowes units. At that time, he had several units going. He would place me with one. The offer was incredible for that time.
And the units were the winners.
Yes. But the time I'm talking about, of course, is a time of great hardship right after the Depression, shortly after that. And the offer was so attractive for those years. I mean, my folks used to go out shopping, come back with two bags filled with groceries, and complain that $5, just like that, went, you know? So, considering the kind of living you could do, and shelter, and survival for the time, and food you could buy, the offer was just staggering. It just wiped everything from my mind about art and becoming an artist. And I said, well, I would just do it as a temporary thing till I could get some money together for my family and then go back to school. So I became a dropout. And I got the appropriate okay signatures from my folks. And Major Bowes sent me out with one of the reviews. I spent a year on the road, working with an act, sending money home, feeling very proud of myself that I was able to contribute to the family. And my plan was to come back and go back to school and continue to living as the child of this family and where my roots apparently were. But one thing began to lead to another. I began to get subsequent offers, which were far in excess of what Major Bowes was paying, and everything then was a temptation to stay out and stay on the road and keep going and keep going and have a new act written for me and pay for it and then get to Chicago and meet Frank Marshall and have him look at the dummy that I was using at the time and carve me a professional model of it. And there I was, getting more and more professional, making more and more money.
So you had a finer
Jerry Mahoney. Absolutely. A more professional version of what I had made. It was based on what I had made, but it was stylized and polished and much more professional and exciting than what I had.
Edgar Bergen style.
So I stayed on the road. I stayed with visits back home and then out again. And I never did go back to complete my art studies, although at 35, I realized how painfully aware I was of my inadequacy academically. So I decided to go back to school, and Columbia University offered some examination, which if you passed would give you your high school equivalent of your diploma, and then accept you for college if you scored well. I was interested at that particular point in medicine. So I went to Columbia, took this exam, got the equivalency of the high school diploma, enrolled into the university, and began an approach to studying medicine. At the same time, I was functioning on a weekly network television show, doing some radio, and some personal appearances at theaters in Manhattan. So I was really only able to stay with it for about a year. It became overwhelming and just knocked me out to handle this much of a curriculum and a workload at the same time. So I finally gave up schooling, but not before I had met a number of doctors who realized that I was very sincere with my medical attention, and they helped me to complete what would be the equivalent of a medical training by giving me their books to study and then inviting me to the hospital, letting me dress up with the appropriate operating gowns and masks and wander through the surgical suites. And everybody knew me, and they would call me to the table and let me watch what they were doing. And together with the study of books, I became quite proficient in the medical world. And that led on to some of my medical involvements today. That takes care of the primitive beginning.
So you were doing Knucklehead Smith and Jerry Mahoney at the same time you were studying to be a doctor?
Yes. Yeah, at the same time I was handling both of them, which if at that time I had found some patron who would support me, I probably would have dropped the show business career and just continued to put the emphasis on the medical career.
Did the fellow doctors recognize you as a star?
Oh yeah, yeah, they knew me. They
probably opened the gates a little easier for you
very helpful.
Than someone else.
Very helpful, it opened a lot of doors for me. Because I don't see any other way that I would have been able to get access to walking freely in hospital suites, surgical suites, and watching what was going on. And the doctors also at that time were getting very interested in hypnosis, which there was a great resurgence at that particular period since Charcot and Mesmer used to work way back in the old days with Freud, and then it became quiet and they gave it up. Freud decided to abandon hypnosis. He didn't feel that it resolved the problems and the conflicts with the patients. But around the 1950s, there was a resurgence in the interest. Just like about 3 or 4 years ago, there was this great boom for acupuncture, which I also took a course in and went to the College of Acupuncturology in Moxibustion. You'll see some of the stuff in what I've given you, and graduated with high on.
There are some people who just train to be an acupuncturist and then just do that the rest of their lives.
Yes, well, I had lots of experience with acupuncture.
So you were able to jump into different areas as a doctor.
Yeah, I've had that kind of facility to be able to handle multi-projects and stay with them. I'm doing a few right now that are very poignant and heartwarming.
There are some people who just train to be an acupuncturist and then just do that the rest of their lives.
Yes, well, I had lots of experience with acupuncture.
So you were able to jump into different areas as a doctor.
Yeah, I've had that kind of facility to be able to handle multi-projects and stay with them. I'm doing a few right now that are very poignant and heartwarming. For some poor little children who are afflicted with certain diseases, and certain types of technology is required to keep them alive, and there's nothing available. So I'm working on that as well. And there's great gratification if you can wind up conceiving something, keep these children alive who would normally succumb in this fatal illness that they have. So aside from the inventions that I've patented with an artificial heart that I developed, which is being used very successfully right now with animals.
I want to get into that.
Yeah. Oh, that's later time. All right.
Can we jump back to how did you land your first television show? That was back in New York that originated from?
Yes, that came from a spinoff on an Ed Sullivan show. I used to do guest shots on these variety programs, among which was the Burl Show, Texaco Star Theater, and the Ed Sullivan Show, the Talk of the Town, or the Toast of the Town, whatever it was called at the time.
Tell me how Knucklehead came into the scene. When did the Knucklehead start?
Knucklehead came in a very backwards way. With Jerry, I had the puppet and the art of ventriloquism first. Then I produced a name for him, and that was kind of a chronological sequence that made sense. But when I got onto TV and radio, the thing that was backwards about Knucklehead is that he was mentioned constantly in the scripts, but there was no Knucklehead. He was just part of the material that we were using. But Jerry would tell me he went out with Knucklehead and they went to this place and this place, and Knucklehead said this, but Knucklehead said that. So I had the character before I had the dummy. And then at one point I said, this Knucklehead guy is getting kind of a dimension to him. people at least know that he's Jerry's friend, maybe I ought to conceive a real figure and bring him into the act so that instead of talking about him, they could have some dialogue between them. And I created Knucklehead by sitting down and saying, why was he called Knucklehead? Well, obviously, he must have had a knuckle on his head or a point or something, like the old Zip characters. And I fashioned, through my knowledge of sculptry, what I thought would be Knucklehead. And then, what kind of voice should he have? So everything went backwards with him. But nonetheless, he evolved and came into being anyway and became one of the cast of characters. That's how Knucklehead came to be.
Now, were you using the other Jerry Mahoney that another puppet maker built, and then using the Knucklehead that you built?
Yes. Yes. Of course, after Frank Marshall built my original figure, and I got into television, I wanted Jerry to be a lot more sophisticated as far as manipulation and controls were concerned. Marshall had not made me a very sophisticated figure. I wanted closing eyes. I wanted rolling eyes. I wanted smoking capacity, squirting out of the ears, and a lot of different raising eyebrows, lots of different things. So from that point on, even though Frank Marshall was responsible for number one, Jerry, I began to make my own Jerrys, sticking as close as I could to what Frank had done.
What was your compound? Was it Scholastic? Or?
Well, back in the old days, they didn't have the selection of materials available that they have today, so I was using plastic wood, which was okay, except there was shrinkage, and it was fragile. If you bumped it too hard, it would crack, and it was difficult to repair because it was kind of like the structure of the particle board that's around today. It was hard to put nails in it or clips if you did fracture it, to tie the fracture together. It was difficult material. Today I work with fiberglass, resins, all kinds of new materials. Well, once if I dropped a dummy, he'd break.
Now, did you ever do that?
Well, yeah, we got.
Or crack the base before?
Oh yeah, cracked, and then figure out how to figure it out. But now, if I drop one, it just bounces right across the floor, and it doesn't break. Plus the fact that the kind of shows I was doing, they were squirting each other with seltzer bottles and hitting each other with eggs and throwing spaghetti all over each other. So the wood would warp. And then sometimes the mouth would expand, the jaw section, because of being wet, and would stick with the mouth open. There would also be a little warpage.
It would stick with the mouth open.
Oh, God, then you were stuck for the show. Anything you could do to shut it again, you know. Of course, I used to break up and laugh at it, but and then reach up and just give it a flick and shut it, and he'd thank me profusely for it. But the material wasn't really as flexible as what we used to.
Do you still have the old papier-mâché one that you started with?
No.
Whatever happened to that?
Well, I was a young kid, and I thought, now I'm getting professional. Now I've got.
I've always wanted to step on it.
Real kinds of figures. That's exactly what I did. Literally and figuratively, I put them on the floor and stamp down on them and pulverize them to bits.
I take it you're not one of these puppeteer ventriloquists that feel that their characters are alive. I just with Nancy Weibel. Do you know Nancy Weibel?
Yes, yes, very well.
With Candy.
Very nice girl.
Yeah. She kind of spooked me a little bit because there was not one time when she walked from her car to when she walked to a car at the end of the reunion where Candy stopped living.
Well, you're liable to get a little bit of that and get spooked again when you meet Edgar.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'll let you make that determination for yourself.
But no,
I'm
not one of those.
No, I'm not one of those guys. I do, of course, compartmentalize my mind, keeping the characters separated, and then going into a very heavy analysis of what kind of people they are, so that I can keep the characters constant. And therefore, on occasion, you will hear me refer, oh no, Jerry wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. Or, well, when he said this, you know, you'll hear me refer to it.
Yeah.
But it's not exactly a slip. It's just that I use that terminology to keep the characters really set for me in my mind.
Yeah.
So it sounds like I might be saying he said this rather than I said this. But it helps me to keep my finger on their characters by referring to them this way.
When you get
but I don't think that when I go to sleep at night, these guys will get up and walk around the house or anything like that.
You don't set them up in the corner of your room looking at you.
Or
like
put them into
zone.
Or put them into bed and pull up the covers. No. Unfortunately, they're even strewn around the garage.
Oh, really?
In their area, bodies all hung up on nails on the wall, heads put on shelves. So not only do I not treat them as entities and put them on chairs, but I even store them in parts.
That's interesting. How many do you think you've had of different versions of Jerry Mahoney's and Knuckleheads?
I think I got about 3 Jerry's and 4 Knuckleheads.
It's not bad considering all that spaghetti and everything.
Yeah. Then of course I got Tessie.
Oh yeah, the
who's Jerry's cousin.
Cousin or girlfriend?
No, she's Tessie Mahoney, his cousin. She's Knucklehead's girlfriend. She came from the East Coast to visit Jerry and became smitten with Knucklehead. But talking about Shari, when we did this Love American style, you know the girl figure that she used?
Yes.
Well, that's Tessie. She didn't have a dummy of her own. She has those hand glove puppets. So I let her borrow Tessie.
Yeah,
but that's Tessie.
Back, yeah.
That's Tessie. And then I have Henry Jones, a black boy. And then I have assorted hand puppets.
Henry Jones, the black, I don't remember him.
Yeah, I used him not on the show. He was a very, very latecomer. I used him mostly on appearances I did on talk shows. Della Reese, Steve Allen, Carson, stuff like that. So,
did he have a black diction sound?
Yes, yes. I was doing a show for ABC who got terribly, terribly sensitive.
Yeah.
And wanted me to make him Calypso so that he would be British. He would begin to talk like this and that and these. But I did it because of the pressure that they exerted, but it just didn't ring right. And I didn't think anybody would become that offended. So I went back to what I believed was right for his character.
Pretty daring to do that.
Well, especially when I introduced him, it was when civil rights was coming in.
Yeah.
So a lot of my material was based upon him putting me down because I showed favoritism to the white figures.
Yeah.
That was the crux of the dialogue that we had, see.
Did you ever get into politics at all?
No,
was
not really.
Was there ever an underlining joke?
No. No, there was no political message or any, there was morality, but not hard and didactic, you know, not stressing it and being teachy with it, just doing little plays. And if there was some inherent value within the context of the play, the kids would get it by identification.
I have a fact sheet. Well, here's an article I have on Edgar Bergen. You've probably seen this one. I've been saving clippings.
Mm-hmm.
This actually is my first book that I started off with a long time ago, and now I have a filing system that just crawls out of my house. Here is a fax.
Oh, and the Howdy Doodies, right? Oh no, this was my show with the slide coming into the clubhouse. Back for NBC in the early 50s.
That must have been in New York.
That's right. Where in the world did you get this page?
Oh, that was out of a book called A Complete Encyclopedia of Television. And they have 2 different volumes of it.
Well, I sure was a young fellow, wasn't I?
Now, is that
the entrance that the kids made at the beginning?
No, the characters on the show. That may be possibly Milton DeLug. I'm not sure who that guy coming in the door is. But they would come, they would ring the bell. I would ask them for the secret password, or Jerry would, or Knucklehead would. They'd have to identify themselves by knowing the password. That would allow the door to open, and they'd come down the slide.
Do you remember some of the passwords?
Scotty Waddy Doo Doo. Oh, yeah. That was the
password. That was usually the...
That was the password.
I forget the theme song. It's just bits and pieces.
So hooray, hurrah, it's when Jill Mahoney time. By the way, in this material I've given you, you'll find a recording of it.
Oh,
there's a record.
Oh, great, I can tape it.
There's a record. Well, the recording itself, the record itself, you may keep.
Oh, really?
Because I have more.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. But you'll also find an envelope filled with photographs, color pictures, because you mentioned you wanted color, too. Well, would you open it up?
Oops, let me move some of this.
Maybe you could open it over. You're going to have a little trouble with the zipper. It will not open. I'm sorry. That's the best I could do at such short notice.
I have the same problem with this thing here, the zipper door.
You'll have to... It'll only unzip, I believe, till where the rubber band was. And then you'll have to kind of get stuff out of that way. That's exactly what I was referring to. This was a presentation originally for the network. There's the recording of the songs. And here are the pictures in the back, the photographs that I told you about.
I can keep the record, but return the rest.
Yes, you may keep the recording, but please return the rest. See, that gives you a color picture that you wanted of Jerry and Knucklehead at the desk. Incidentally, with everybody who is using dummies with moving hands, including the Muppets, I'm the creator and the originator of the moving arms and moving legs, with Jerry and Knucklehead dancing, playing the drums, playing Swiss bells, shining shoes, all kinds of things that we did way back then.
The mouse's name was...
Irv Fink.
And
the snail on the right-hand side there is Snitchy.
Snitchy.
Mm-hmm. He was a snitcher, always telling everybody. Snitchy the snail.
This I can use, yeah.
Yes, you could, whatever you want.
More.
I think you even have that picture of that upside down carrot. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
See, now here's the illusion on this. When you look at it this way, you see what appeared on the screen.
Oh, yeah.
When you look at it that way, you see my chin painted.
Yeah, that I remember. You used to use it all the time.
Yeah.
Almost each show. Now here you're playing different characters.
Mm-hmm.
They
would come down the slide. They were the citizens of a place called Funsville.
And
they would come in. Grandpa Winch, my father. I owned the barn where I allowed these children and dummies to run their club meetings. He and Grandma ran the farm for me. Mm-hmm. So he's my father, Grandma's my mother. I'm the guy that owns, and I'm a ham bone. I was functioning as an actor at the local Bijou Theater downtown Funsville. But I'd come in every once in a while to see what the kids were doing and what was up.
Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.